Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for holding and welcome to Robert Ringer's Mastermind Discussion Group. Your host today is Mike Riley. Mr. Riley, you may now begin.
Thank you, Katie, and welcome again, everyone, to the third Robert Ringer Mastermind Discussion Group conference call. Now let's get on with the show and allow the man who needs no introduction to this group, our main source of inspiration and life lessons, Robert Ringer.
Thanks, Mike. Well, today's kind of a special, it's a special Mastermind Discussion Group call for me because our guest is a longtime personal friend of mine. We go back almost 30 years together, and I've watched in awe as I've seen him operate in the business world and in his personal life also. Because our guest is a somewhat secretive individual who values his privacy, we're going to call him by a pseudonym today. He's going to go by the name of Leo. And I'm going to start right in. Leo lives right now in Bermuda and has for many years. And I'm going to start right in and ask Leo to explain himself why he uses a pseudonym and how this all came about, this secretive way of life, why he likes to live a secret life. And I'll start out by saying right out, I don't think he'll mind me saying it. He is definitely a centimillionaire and leads a life just about, I think, unlike any life I've ever seen anyone live. So, Leo, you want to take it from there and explain to our members why you use a pseudonym?
Well, the word secret puts a lot of people off. I would prefer the word privacy. There's really nothing in the nature of secrecy about it. I just lived in the trenches, so to speak, for so many years, and I began using unlisted phone numbers probably 25 or 30 years ago, and when I formally retired about 20 years ago, I just decided that I wanted more or less like Thoreau on his Walden Pond, I wanted to retire to something that was as private and as peaceful as I could. And I picked a location that met that definition, and I have preferred to just stay completely out of the bullseye. And it's just a desire to be quiet after years and years of living in the trenches and operating in the bullseye.
Now, right now you live in Bermuda in quite a home, one of the most famous homes in Bermuda. And I know for years you lived in Colorado and Aspen, I believe, in the highest peak in all of Aspen, wasn't it? And
yeah.
I think what's interesting about it is that at the time, I don't know whether it's changed, I believe it was on the front of the Wall Street Journal that you sold your home in Aspen when you moved to Bermuda. At the time you sold it, it was the biggest residential real estate sale in the history of Colorado, I believe. Is that correct?
That is. I don't know how they got the information, but they did.
And I remember the day that appeared in the Wall Street Journal. What I'd like you to do for our members, Leo, is start back beginning at your roots, because what you've accomplished, and they're going to see this soon, is quite amazing. And tell them a little bit about your roots and how you grew up, and we'll evolve into step-by-step how you got to where you are today.
Well, I'll give a short answer to that and let you ask me to expand on it if you want me to. I was born and raised in a middle-class family. I was the son of a lawyer and the grandson of a judge, both of whom died broke. They had worked by the hour or worked for someone else, and they were very good at what they did, and they worked very hard, and they died with their boots on, that is, working. And when I became a lawyer, I became a lawyer because nothing else to my then pubescent mind seemed to make much sense. However, I realized early on that unless I did something very different from that which my father and grandfather had done, I would also die poor. So I began doing something else. Actually, I took a job took a job as a sales manager for an electronics company in Boston. I knew nothing about sales, but the president of the company convinced me that I should do it. and it proved to be extremely lucrative for me. And in the span of about 5 years, I made a fair amount of money. I became general sales manager nationally for that company, and I saved some money. And I was able to, when I realized I was tired of working for someone else, I realized I was falling into that trap. I resigned from that company and decided to start my own law practice. And but keeping in mind that the important thing was not to work by the hour, but rather to, I was mindful of the words of Napoleon, of Earl Nightingale. Actually, the first words that stuck in my mind were, "No one will pay you what you'll pay yourself." Nightingale was a great lecturer at the time, a motivational speaker. He also said that wealth isn't defined by what you make nearly as much as by what you own. And that made a lot of sense to me, because my father and grandfather had made good livings, but they needed all of it to live, and when they died, there was literally nothing left. So I wanted to find a way to develop ownership interests. And that when I began practicing law, I began to search around for ideas of things that I could help clients start and obtain an equity interest in them. Now, Bob, you want to inject anything? You want me to just keep going here?
No, I you're on just the track I wanted to see for our members, because I think the important thing, and we don't want to get off of this too quick, is that you were able to figure out at a very young age that it's not how much you earn, it's what you end up owning, and that, of course, no one will pay you what you'll pay yourself, and I think Robert Kiyosaki talks a lot about that. And I know that we have at least one attorney on the phone here who has moved out of the practice of law, and I think he may have come to the same conclusion that just practicing, being a lawyer and working by the hour, you're never going to really get rich. The lawyers who are really wealthy are not guys who just practice law. So go on from there and tell the story of how you came to this conclusion at a very young age, that how you were going to have to work with your clients in order to get a piece of the deal and not just work by the hour.
Quick, let me inject that I've read all of Robert's books. I was an early fan and reader, and I want you all to know that I am not the legal man to whom he has referred so many times in less than the most favorable terms.
Yep.
I'm not. I only practiced law for about 15 years. As soon as I saw my way out of it, I got out of it, and I did. But when I started practicing law with no base whatsoever, after chasing a few ambulances and writing a few wills and doing some messy divorce cases, in less than probably 6 months, I realized that this was insane. I was going nowhere fast. I had saved enough money in my sales work to live for several years, even though I had a wife and two children at the time. So I wasn't pressed at the moment. But while I was doing this, I've always looked for things that are new, or things that I can do in a new and better way. And when I was looking about in the law practice, lamenting the fact that I had another divorce case on my desk, I was listening to I think about the only FM radio station where I was then living, and I realized how wonderful the signal quality was in pre-FM. If those of you who have made a comparison, at least in those days, an FM signal was probably 10 times the quality or fidelity of an AM signal, and yet there were basically no FM radio stations to speak of in the United States at that time. And the reason was that there were basically no radios out there. And, of course, there were no FM radios because there were no FM stations. As a result of this, the Federal Communications Commission had trouble giving away FM licenses. Well, I looked at FM and listened to it and thought to myself, it's just a question of time until FM is going to become the dominant radio vehicle. It just seemed to me as patent as anything could be. So I began to put together groups I put in some of my own money, but I couldn't put in too much because I had to live on it. And with a few friends, we began applying for FM radio licenses. And they were very easy to get. They were not competitive. We were often the only applicant. And we acquired a number of those stations. We put them on the air. And, of course, they were, in some cases, I put in perhaps only 5 or 10% of the money, but since I was more or less the driving force of the deal, I negotiated a better equity position. I had a carried interest in addition to a paid interest, and I got as much as I could, and that interest varied, of course, a great deal. But in each of those stations, we put them on the air. They were not overnight successes. A number of them almost went under before they turned the corner, but none of them ever did. And they, when they all turned the corner, we eventually sold them and sold them all to public companies. But that took well over 10 years. This was, when we started doing this, was the early 60s, and we didn't start selling them probably until the 70s. By about the middle 60s, I realized that we were running out of easy-to-acquire FM licenses. The world had gotten onto the scent of that, and everybody was applying for them. So the game, I've always said I've lived off the crumbs of other men's tables. And I've also noted that one of the reasons that I've succeeded is that I've participated in races where I'm often the only runner, or I am the first runner on the track, or I have a substantial head start. And all I need to do is finish perhaps second or third. I don't even need to be first. So when you run on a track with less competition, you have a much better chance of winning. And when I went into FM radio, basically we were the only ones on the track. And though there is a time problem in being first. You can be too soon. You can jump the gun and go under, and somebody come right behind you and do the same thing and succeed because they're a year later. So there is a sensitivity to the time. You have to be careful about that. But in any event, with the cable TV situation, I looked at that, but it was then called Community Antenna Television, CATV. I looked at that because at that time, in the early 1960s, it was only really operating in mountainous towns, towns wherein television signals off the air could not reach most or all of the homes in the community. In those communities, they would put an antenna on the highest hill around, run a unshielded wire down to the community, and connect up the homes, and they would get questionable signals, but they'd get whatever was available on the top of the hill. And that's the only place cable was. Well, we wanted to take it into markets where they had off-the-air television signals. And everybody said at the time that it wouldn't work. And they would argue with us. I mean, if we went to the town fathers and asked for a franchise, they would say, why should we give you a franchise to do this? No one will buy your service. We'd say, why is that? Because we already have one off-the-air television signal. And we would say, yes, but that's NBC, and you don't have CBS or ABC, and you don't have an independent station. There were no public broadcast stations at that time. And we'd say, you don't have the, they're different. Yes, but they said you can only watch one thing, so no one will bother. We said, well, we don't believe that. And they said, well, tell you what, we will not let you put a cable system in here unless you post a bond that gives us enough money to take your wires down after you fail. Well, we didn't have enough money to post a very big bond. So what we did is we would say, look, I'll tell you what, we'll put in two blocks of cable television. We'll put in a head end on the hill. We'll put up some antennas. We'll run a wire down to the closest block we can get. We'll do that block. We'll put up a bond to cover that. And then we'll see what kind of saturation we get, and then we'll come back to see you and give you a report and see if you'll go along with a second block. They said, that's fine. So when we put in the first block of cable, we would then go to knock on a door in the middle of the street there and say, would you have a tea party, if you will have a tea party for your neighbors on this block and let us show our service, we will give you free service for a year. And they'd say, well, why not? So we would have a tea party there. And 9 out of 10 houses on the block would see the cable and they would take it. We charged $300 to install it and $1.95 and a month, and we delivered five channels of service, and that's all that was then available was a five-channel system called a low-band system. In any event, we basically financed it with installation fees, and we built the early systems that way. Then as we lowered the fees, once we got the manufacturers convinced that we were good for the money, we were able to borrow as much as 150% of the construction costs, which covered construction and operating capital for 18 months. And we were able to do that, and that enabled us to lower the installation fees gradually. Over a period of time, we got them down to $29.95 or something. Of course, they've been zero forever, I guess, now. And we went to a high-band system, which was 12 channels, which was the ultimate in technology. There would never be anything greater than that in cable television, so the consensus was at the time. And in any event, we gradually grew with the industry, and we went into more and more markets, not only with one off-the-air television signal, but with two, and with even three, and finally with even four. And then finally we got to the major markets where they have an abundance of television signals, and we competed with those too. So I did that for almost 20 years. And slowly, I never went public. I never was in a company that went public. Everything we did, we sold to private companies. To public companies, and most of those public companies were eaten by other public companies. So everything that I did in cable has since been absorbed. As we ran out of that, we began that process in the early 60s and in the mid 60s. We basically completed it by the early 70s. We had done everything we could do. And the competition had gotten too tough, as it once did in FM. The competitors were too big, they were throwing around too much money, and we decided it was time to move on to something else. So we began to look around once again. And I had an acquaintance who kept telling me that he had a small interest in an engineering company with about five employees that was doing this thing called cellular telephone.
And Leo, before we go on to cellular, can I ask you a couple of questions?
Shoot.
Because you have thrown out a ton of great, you know, I zero in on the philosophy, and you said a ton of things here that I'd like you to elaborate on. The first great one was that you, and I've heard you say it before, that you've always lived off the crumbs of other men's tables, if those are the exact words.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd like you to elaborate on that a little bit, because these are things that I think our members can take away and really think about and put to use themselves, because the point is, you didn't worry about being the big honcho in any industry. I think what I've seen of your operations, you represented a lot of companies that were, what, billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar companies?
Yeah, I did at one time.
And took anywhere from 1% to, what, 5% of deals, which looked very small at the time?
More often than not, it was in that range. Sometimes
yeah.
It got up to 10 or
gigantic
so.
Gigantic deal. So why don't you elaborate on that a little bit? Because this
well, you know, Robert, if you don't have any money, or by the standards of people who have serious investment capital, if you don't really have it, you can't compete with investors. So you have to talk your way into carried interest as best you can. And I did that. You know, if I did it in several dozen FMs, I did it in over 50, probably closer to 75 cable television systems. And most of them, I ended up somewhere between 1% and 10% of the system. And a lot of them started out in very small towns. I mean, there were towns that had one off-the-air signals. And when they were sold, maybe they sold for a few million dollars, and I got, you know, $150,000 or $300,000 or whatever it was. But then later I got into major markets, and I ended up with 5% of markets that were worth hundreds of millions of dollars. And I had, as I say, I was in, you know, 50 to 75 of those things. Now, if you have enough crumbs, you know, you have a serious meal. And I found, too, it was in a way a blessing. It's not unlike people who make large incomes as a, you know, a doctor or as an actor or something else, and then all of a sudden it's gone for some reason, through injury or age or something else, and they find themselves, they've spent their money and they're basically on skid row. That didn't happen to me because the interests I had were small. I got these individual checks one at a time, and I developed a rule for myself to protect myself from profligate activities. When I got a large check, whatever it was, $100,000, $1 million, $5 million, whatever it was, I put, number one, I put whatever the tax money was in a separate account, and I literally called it my tax account. And the rest of it, I took 10% of the rest, and I put it in what I call a mad money account. And I would sit down with my wife and say, what do you want? You want a fur coat? You want a trip? Do you want a ring? Do you want a car? What do you want? And I really never cared what I had to speak of. You know, I don't wear jewelry or any of those kind of things. So I really, what, you know, a vacation to me or, you know, a TV was fine with me. But in any event, I put that 10% in there, and I literally let that get blown. The rest of that money I put away. The rest of that money I put away. And that's how I built myself for retirement. And if you get a whole series, literally probably over 100 businesses that I helped start and sold, every time one of those things sold, as a friend of mine used to say, if we stop sending the ships out with goods, they'll stop returning with gold. So, and that's a major point. You never can stop, whether you're sending out FM radio or cellular or cable television or cellular telephone, or you're opening hot dog stands or whatever it is you're doing. When you stop creating those new things, that money stops coming in at the other end. But living off crumbs is basically relates to the fact that I did not have the money to take controlling ownership positions. I do have that kind of money now, and if I feel like it, I do it.
And so this all relates back to something that I've written about a number of times, and I was writing about you, even though it was I kept it anonymous, and that is that your big breakthrough, that you're this attorney sitting there, as you say, with your green shade on and getting paid by the hour. And your big breakthrough was when you figured out all on your own that the only way that you were ever going to get rich was to have the nerve to ask for what you thought were worth you were worth. And I guess it sounds like Earl Nightingale's statement probably played into that in a big way and got you thinking about it, huh?
Well, let me just say, for example, in FM radio or in cable television, if I would call someone I knew in a community, for example, had an FM station, I helped put them there. And I would call them up and say, Robert, you know this FM station that you've got in Keokuk, Iowa, I know a business, and I know what that business makes because we've talked about it. I know a business that would make you probably a multiple of 10 times that we can do with other people's money. Would you be interested in talking about that? And you'd say, well, yes, I am. And I'd say, well, it's called Community Antenna TV, now known as Cable TV. And you'd say, what's that? Because 9 out of 10 people had never heard about it when I went into it. Literally, my neighbors had no idea what I did if I told them. So I would explain the business to you, and I said, I'll tell you what, Robert, if you'll pay my costs to come out to Keokuk, Iowa, and sit down with you, if you don't like what I have to say, no charge, I'll go home, and I'll buy you dinner, and we'll forget about it. But you'd say, sounds good to me. So you'd send me the money for the ticket. I would fly out to see you. I would sit down, and while I was there, I would convince you that I can find you the engineering to build and operate the system, number and staff it, and number two, I can find you the capital at that point in time in excess of 100% of the construction capital. And what I wanted from you was X dollars to write the franchise application, as the case might be, or do whatever the legal work was related to it. I wanted extra. And I also said, I want a retainer of $500 a month as long as you own this business. In other words, I wanted a little annuity. It's not a lot of money, but $500 was a lot more money, you know, 40 years ago, obviously, than it is today. So, or 30 years, 40 in most cases. I'd say $500 a month, and then the final thing is, I want 5% of your business non-dilutable. And basically to most people, they didn't have any problem with that proposition. And
I
never made a
proposition. Probably sounded small to them.
Look, you know, Robert, I always made a proposition. I always, whenever I go into a deal, I believe in concomitance of economic interest. That means my interest and the guy's, everybody at the table has to be basically on the same side of the table. Everybody has to believe that they got a good deal. And I've always sacrificed on my own end, if need be, to make the deal work. And if I had to sacrifice too much, it was a bad deal and I didn't do it. But the concomitance of economic interest and making the other guy happy, I wore the hat of everybody in that table. When I went to bargain at that table, when I put out a proposition, it was a proposition that if I sat in any chair at that table, if I was the owner, if I was the financier, if I was the engineer, or if I was in my chair doing legal and putting it together and whatever, everybody was happy with the deal, and they were.
And you did, and I think you should emphasize for our people, you didn't do that for altruistic reasons. You did it because it was pragmatic. It's the only way that the deal was going to work, right?
Well, that's absolutely true. Altruism, unfortunately, won't feed your family. I think if you have developed independent wealth or inherited it or something, you can be an altruist, and God bless you. But most of us have to work for a living. I always have, and nobody's ever paid my way, so I can't be altruistic. I do it because it's good business to make a good business deal.
Great. Now, I want to go back to a couple other statements that you made. Run on a, some of these quotes are amazing. I'm going to have to write an article about this. Run on a track with less competition. It sounds so simplistic, but it's profoundly simplistic. And I think people really want to give that a lot of thought when they get off of this call, because a lot of people jump into things where there's always too much competition, and yet you said being too early can be bad. And if there's one thing I've heard about you, even from others over the years, and I know it from firsthand experience, is that you have been a master at identifying profitable deals, profitable areas, profitable industries. So what advice would you give to somebody how they can get into this in-between position where they're not too early? Because I always say it's better to follow a pioneer than be a pioneer. They're not too early where the bad mistakes are made, but they don't come in after the competition was too great. Because as you said, after 10 years or so in FM radio, you were really successful, but then the competition was getting intense.
It was history.
And what does it do? What Henry has
it was a big money game then. It was only for guys who could buy their way in.
Right. But it then, once an industry is successful, as the great economist Henry Hazlitt said, you can count on it. It's going to attract big capital, right?
That's right.
So what advice would you give to people who are trying to figure out how to find the deals, the industries, where they're not too soon, but the competition?
Well, I'll give two more examples, and I'll do it very, very briefly. When cable began to peter out, or when we'd done everything we could, cable didn't peter out. Cable was just getting going. When I got into cable television, you could buy a subscriber for $50. When I got out of cable television, you could buy one for $800, and today you have to pay $4,000. So I didn't get the last dollar, and I didn't sell for the first, but I got a heck of a ride in the middle, and I didn't pay $50. That's what people paid for them who bought them in those days. I got them for nothing. But when cable became difficult to do for the same reasons that FM did. Too many people got in it, and it got too competitive. And you know, people got in it who could run faster, who were taller and swifter and stronger and better financed and smarter and everything else than I. I got out. That is, I kept my interest, and they sold when they sold, and that was the end of it. I stopped thinking about it, and I got into cellular telephone through this engineering firm, and I was in a handful. I was in several dozen of those things in the early going, and when that began to peter out, that was a star that burned like Halley's Comet. You know, it burned very brightly, very briefly, and then it fell into the difficulties of of making one of those systems profitable, and that's very, very hard to do. And the most money was made in cellular by people who didn't try to do that. They just got in early and got licenses and got out. From there I went into automated teller machines because they changed the law in 1995 to allow non-banks to go into the automated teller machine business. Well, thousands, anybody, anyone in this phone call, any man, woman, or child, you know, could buy an ATM machine. They could sell it. They could service it. They could own it and operate it, whatever they wanted. And it was a new business. And that it was like the Oklahoma Gold Rush, from which the name Sooners emerged. Everybody went at once. Well, that was difficult because thousands of people went after it at the same time, and the competition became too tough, too fast. But what we did is we narrowed our focus to a slim segment of that market. Specifically, we went after what we call high-end locations. We went after airports, malls, shopping centers, and large hotels. And we built, we now operate ATM machines in 45 states or so, and we've been in the business 10 years, and we've been profitable for 7 years. It's not a gold mine, but it's done well, and we're glad to have been in it. Now, those are one thing I should be quick to add is I've done many ventures that failed. Many that were aborted in the early going or just flat failed, and that is restaurants, long-distance telephone, attempts to control machines with remote wireless devices, importing and exporting into China. When China really became appealing in the late 80s and the early 90s, I had some friends who had some contacts there, and it seemed like a good opportunity, and we tried importing various things into China. We tried exporting some things, and we tried to also to obtain some licenses for various kinds of radio telecommunications devices. Every one of those ventures failed, and we didn't. You never lose more than you can afford to, and so I view a lot of businesses like a stock, you know, which is another way to lose money, in my opinion. But unless you are a 24-hour a day, 52 weeks of the year, for a couple of decades, it's a very tough game. And so I view a lot of these ventures now pretty much as the way I would buy a stock. And I'll put out as much as I can afford to lose and nothing more. But I don't want to give your listeners the false impression that I haven't had failures, because I've had plenty of them. But the key is the ones that have succeeded have paid me, 10 times, 20 times, 50 times, sometimes even more than that on the money put up. Therefore, I can afford a number of failures.
And Leo, you always told me, and this goes back probably more than 20 years ago, that your philosophy was to always have like five balls up in the air. I think it's very important at one time, knowing that you know that you're not infallible by any means, and knowing that maybe four of them are going to fall to the floor. But as you said, you get into things that are big enough, so it's going to be, you're going to be fine if four fall and one succeeds, right?
Yes, that's true. And I also should add to that, you have to, when you start something, you've got to watch it so closely to see whether or not what the signs of difficulty are, what the failures are. As Bill Gates said in Business at the Speed of Thought, give me the bad news first. The good news can wait. And I think with all our businesses, we need to find out what the bad news is as fast as we can. And I'm precipitous to go into things. I'm a congenital optimist. I think you have to be, because otherwise you don't take risks. If you don't take risks, you can't win much. But I also can be precipitous in bailing or jumping ship And that's, I have to check myself on that, because I tend to go into things with very high expectations, and or I wouldn't go into them if I didn't have them, and rarely do I reach those high expectations in the early going. There are cases where I did, but in most cases you don't, and then you have to back up and say, can I handle the problems that are here? Rather, don't jump ship. I mean, when we went into the ATM business for almost 2 years, we were every month we sat down and thought about closing the business. But every month we made the decision to go another month or quarter, whatever it was. And eventually, after about a year and a half, it began to turn the corner, and it worked out very nicely. So I think recognizing the problems, addressing them, and this is a key point. If it looks like you can't manage the problems, get out. Don't put good money after bad, and your time is money too.
And how did you arrive at that decision in the long distance telephone business, for example? I remember when you were in that and you cut your losses and got out. What do you think was the problem with that you didn't have in cable and FM radio?
You know, that remains a bit of an enigma to me, because we had about 50 people working for us in New York City, right downtown in Manhattan, and salespeople all over the country, and I never really could get to the bottom of why that failed. By that point in my career, I was pretty far removed from hands-on management. Most things that I've done, I've stayed pretty close to micromanaging, and even though I have division heads and I do believe in them and I do take advice, whether it's a doctor or a lawyer or a partner or somebody like you, I do listen to good advice and I do take it. But in that case, I got too far away from the day-to-day operations. Everything we tried didn't work. And finally, the guy who was general managing it for me, whom you know, main nameless, but whom you know, and I chatted about it. We decided we ought to look for a buyer, and funny thing is, he found all on his own. I had nothing to do with it. He found a buyer who had been an ex-partner of mine in a public cable TV company, and they paid us a multiple of about 3 times what we hoped would be our cash flow in a couple of years, and we just hit the road smiling. You know, we were so glad to get out of there. I don't know how they ever did. I never talked to the guy about it.
Amazing, amazing. You
said if I could just jump in here just to remind our listeners, if you do have a question for our guest Leo or Robert, please press the number 1, and Katie will be happy to get to you as soon as we can. Go ahead, gentlemen.
Now, Leo, you said something that's very dear to my heart. You talked about it, and I think it's very inspiring, when you were trying to do these cable deals, that all you heard was negativism, negativism, negativism. And as
exactly.
You know, one of my earliest things that I wrote about in Winning Through Intimidation was the discouragement fraternity. It had a whole chapter on it. And I talked about how negative people are, and allow your enthusiasm, if you allow your intellect, if you allow what you feel strongly about to be influenced by people who are negative, you're probably going to have a difficult time ever succeeding, because almost without fail, anything that I've ever done that has succeeded, I never have to look far for naysayers. And I think it's important to tell the people why you kept pressing forward, because it would have been easy for you to just, you know, shut your briefcase and go home, but you obviously believed in what you were doing. And I thought, you talk about resourcefulness. You know, I always say that success is not about resources, it's about resourcefulness. And you showed a lot of resourcefulness there when you did that one block deal, and I think that can be extended to real estate or any other kind of deal where you got them in slowly, easily. You made it an easy decision for them, and then you went on a basis of you were going to prove yourself or else, and that showed a lot of confidence. Why don't you elaborate on that a little bit, because I think that's something people can really take away.
Focus again, summarize that question again.
Focus on is the fact that all these people were very negative when you came into their towns and wanted to set up the cable systems, and yet you forged ahead anyway, and what it was that gave you that confidence and how you came up with that idea to just service one block and do it on a prove-it basis. Because I think everybody out there, no matter what business they're in, can use that same approach when they're trying to sell their deal to somebody.
Well, you have to remember, whatever it is you decide to do, most people don't agree with you, or by definition, or many more people would be trying to do what you're doing. And the minute you show any signs of success, that is exactly what will happen. You will be joined immediately by lots of other people. I think it comes down to the fact that you have confidence in yourself. And I believe that, I think that people can start the proverbial hot dog stand and make a success out of it. Nothing is easy. Lord knows, not a hot dog stand. But I had a friend who started them with no money, and he ended up with 13 fast food restaurants, and he did all right. So I think it's just a question of believing in what you've chosen to do and developing a plan, a five-year plan, which you break into a three-year plan and then down to a one-year plan, which breaks into a quarterly plan, which is a monthly plan, and that becomes a weekly plan. And finally, you know what you got to do today. And that, I've always had five-year plans on everything I've done. I don't think anyone can see past. I don't think anyone can see 5 years. But certainly, that is the horizon for human mental vision in business situations, because there are too many variables. It's like chess. Depends upon what the other person does. Two or three moves out as to where you're going to be. So business is the same thing. But I've just simply believed very much, whether it was FM radio or cable TV or cellular telephone or ATM, which are ones that succeeded, I firmly believed that those were good situations and the time was right for them, and I just pursued them until I was successful or pulled back. And in those four cases, they were successful, so I never pulled back.
Well, I just think I was very resourceful, and then you took the Tupperware approach. I mean, talk about recasting an old idea. I mean, that basically was Tupperware, and you end up throwing tea parties in one person's house, give them the free cable, and everyone else signs up. And I think it just emphasizes again, folks, that it's all about resourcefulness and marketing, because this man on the phone who's worth way over $100 million now, I know that, and he started out, and he did it basically with Scotch tape, and you don't need the capital to start. You don't need the resources as much as you need resourcefulness. Now, when you went to these people, you said you went to people and said, look, I got a deal for you. If you pay my plane ticket, I'll come out there. So you were looking for people who were heavy hitters or fairly substantial, because you were showing them how they could get in without putting up any money. So why did you need them? For their financial statements or what?
Well, and actually, no. In the case of cable television, we wanted to have some strength. You're getting, in this case, a license from town fathers to put cable on the poles in the public rights of way. So you need someone who knows the town council, knows who they are.
Oh,
and,
so they're,
you know, preferably,
they're up to any citizen.
You know, their wife plays bridge with their wife or something.
Okay.
I mean, at least you've got some friendship. So you want someone who knows the community.
I see.
So we developed a very locally oriented presentation for that. And if you take a local businessman, a guy who owns the radio station in town, they say, well, we know Robert, he owns XYZ FM, you know, and they're good to everybody, and we'd like to be interviewed on there and be well treated by him and his employees. So, you know, if he's coming in here wanting a cable deal, we'll certainly listen to him.
Well,
Excuse me, gentlemen.
Yeah.
We do have a question in queue.
Okay, go ahead.
You want to go ahead? Charles Covis, Mr.
Hello,
Covis.
Robert. Hello, Leo. I'm ringing again, way ahead of you guys, because I'm in Australia.
Yeah, you're in Melbourne or in Queensland?
I'm in Melbourne.
Melbourne, okay.
So it's now Friday morning, so and I can't tell you the stock prices for you, but never mind. Now, two questions, I'm happy, Leo, if you take these on board, because I know they're slightly difficult questions. But I used to be a lawyer. I don't know whether I'm the attorney you were talking about, Robert, but anyway, I practiced law for 20 years, and now I'm a professional speaker and also involved in treatment of wastewater, taking your advice, Leo, in terms of taking a carried interest. My question to you is, what key discipline did you practice over the last 20 years? And secondly, what's been your philosophy? I'll call it time management, but of course it's a silly concept because it's really personal management. But these two elements of, I've got too much on my plate, so I'm going, how, and I'm constantly trying to work out how to maximize my time use, but I'm interested in what you imposed on a discipline on yourself as a human being, and secondly, your philosophy on how you got all this done in limited amounts of time.
Well, those are
now
big.
You might think about that as we're going, but you know, something inside you, and this is what I teach as well, and if I'm interested in, you know, hey, what was the discipline? Robert, you know, you've got your disciplines, and I've read about them, and Leo, I want to know what the killer discipline was for you.
Well, I think Leo's very disciplined, but I'm going to let him answer that himself. If you want to answer it right off or you want to wait, Leo, it's up to you. But I know in watching you over the years, I know what I think your strengths are in those areas. And,
well, go ahead.
Well, some of them you alluded to, like how many people would close a big deal and take 90% of the money, pay the taxes, take 90% of the money, set it aside, have fun, do something for the wife with 10%. And I think that tells you worlds about how Leo has operated, because I want to tell you a couple other little secrets about Leo that he maybe wasn't going to mention, but they've meant a lot to me, and I've picked up on them. I've used them over the years. I remember when he told me he pays all his utilities in advance, and I started doing that, and instead of having 40 or 50 bills a year for your gas, electric, even telephone, you can pay in advance and just have a credit balance. It gets down to making your life simple so that you can concentrate on the money-making activities. You know, one of my earliest mentors was the late Harry Brown. And I remember when Harry said, and Harry was not a rich man by any means, but he said, you should never fool around with 10, 20, 50, or even $100 items. Worrying about the tab at a restaurant and is the addition correct. He said, because half the times that there's a mistake, it'll be against you, and half the times it'll be for you. But it gets down to how much your time is worth an hour. And you shouldn't, as they say, sweat the little stuff. And Leo taught me that about paying your utilities in advance. And also, Leo, explain to them your philosophy on the cash cushion for overhead, because what he's basically done throughout his career is, for the most part, escaped this enormous financial pressure that most people find themselves under that detracts from their really making the big money. Tell them about your cash cushion theory, Leo.
All right. I'm reminded of Gates talking about when he started Microsoft in 82 or some such, that they at one point got within 30 days or something of closing the doors. That is, they were out of money. And, of course, we all know how that story turned out. I, as a matter of fact, have been in several businesses where we were 90 days, 60 days, even 30 days from the day of closing the business. And I mean, if money hadn't come in, we would literally have had to close those businesses in those time frames. So I faced that many times, and I don't know how many, but of course much, much earlier in my career, when I was in my 20s and 30s, early 30s. But this taught me that the first thing I tried to do in every business was develop a cash cushion. And, you know, you start out with a reasonable goal. I want to put aside 90 days worth of operating expenses. Okay, that's something you have to set a goal that you think you can achieve, you know. And then when I got to 90 days, I'd say, okay, I want to set one for 6 months, and I'd work on that. And when I got there, I'd say, I want one for a year. And I always, thereafter, I maintained that a year was the minimum amount of cash that I wanted to have in all areas of my life to cover whatever the costs of those areas were. If it was a business or a second business or a third business, it applied. If it was managing my house, it applied. If it was covering children's education, it applied. I try to be a year ahead, and that's my cash cushion theory. You mentioned sweating the little stuff, and I've really always been a believer in that. And I think I told you years ago, Robert, that at some points in my career when I had what was clearly a failing business, even though it didn't fail, it appeared at the time to be a failing business, one of the first things I did was economize all my expenses. And I would make a very diligent sort of a martinet's approach to all of my expenses, and I would stop taking all any magazine that wasn't critical, any subscription, any newspaper. I would cut the coffee in the kitchenette. I would start rationing pencils and paper clips that went out of the file room, and monitoring paper supplies, which can disappear with any size of staff. I started monitoring all this little stuff, and when the day was over, it didn't make enough difference to warrant my time. I found the only thing that's, because if you're not profligate, if you're not just throwing money down the rat hole, you're probably fairly much within reason of your expenses. The only thing that would ever save me in a business situation like that is to concentrate on income. Have to concentrate on income. Got to find a way to change the income. So that's what I turned on. So as to sweating the little stuff, that's part of it on that. Conversely, I'll always say, as a guy who has done every kind of job you can think of in the early going through school, and after that, I waited tables for 6 years. I used to sing in a bar. I've driven a cab, whatever. You do what you have to do. This is mainly in school. But I became a tipper, and there's nothing I enjoy in life more than giving big tips. And I've kind of always done it as soon as I could afford it, and I still do it, and it doesn't change my life, and I love it so much. I just love seeing that. It's one form of charity that I have, but it's related to sweating the little stuff.
So the bottom line is, put it another way, you don't concentrate on problems, you concentrate on opportunities. Because kind of like what Joe Vitale said, the more you think about what you don't want, that's what you're going to get. It's kind of a distant cousin to that, but don't concentrate on problems, concentrate on opportunities. No matter, you can only cut your expenses so much. You can cut yourself right out of business. But if you increase income, expenses aren't a problem anymore. Now, since we're running out of time here, Leo.
One other thing I just want to say to the last question. He asked about disciplines. You mentioned some, and they were right on. And I would also say, being a workaholic, I know that's not much help, but time management and really giving it 110% effort, being focused, concentrating, and putting in the time, and not letting myself, making myself do what I had to do. And that's stating the obvious, and I apologize if it's too basic, but
what do you mean by that, Leo? It's making yourself do what you had to do.
Exactly. Every day, I never put it, it's the trite saying, I never put off till tomorrow or try not
right.
to. What I can do today, I try never to do that.
Right. Now, we're going to close on a real high note here, and we don't have a lot of time, but I want to go in to the last Grand Slam home run, and that was cellular. You went from FM radio to cable, and then the next big opportunity that you saw was cellular telephone. Of course, I got involved with you at a point where no one I knew had any idea what I was talking about. They had absolutely no idea what cellular telephone was, and I was just amazed when I started getting into it. And tell our listeners how you came across cellular telephone.
Let me give you it's a funny story. I was riding in New York with an associate and client of mine, and he has a beautiful home in Greenwich, and we were riding from New York up to Greenwich in his car, and he had a car phone, not a cellular phone. He had a pre-cellular car phone. It was about the size of a small suitcase between the two seats in the front of the car. He was so proud of it, and I think it was a Bentley or something, and we were driving it, and he was driving it, and he said, let's have fun. Let's make some phone calls. So we're coming out of the city. So he tries to dial, and it's busy. And then he tries again in a minute or so, and it's busy. Well, it was about an hour and a half to his house. He kept trying all the way. He never got a line. Finally, I inquired into this and determined that the car phones in those days, there were five channels. People said cellular wouldn't work, and that it wouldn't make money, and it was a bad idea. That was the basic premise. Why did they say that? They said that because there were already car phones in the United States. What they hadn't looked into is there are only five channels allotted to each market. And on each channel in that technology, only one conversation could be had. So two people could talk on each channel, or 10 people in all. Now this was true whether you were in Poughkeepsie, New York, or New York City. You had 10 people could talk at one time.
Amazing.
Well, we concluded that it was ludicrous, and that the minimum we could do is there were going to be two cellular licenses awarded to each market. And we did projections assuming that we would get 1% saturation. Nobody believed us. No bankers, no equipment companies, nobody believed us. Couldn't raise a dime on it. And we did experimental systems. I was in, five of maybe of the first 10 systems in the U.S. And we basically had to fund it in the most obscure ways. And, of course, the fact of the matter is, I mean, we did it with equity, and it was like pulling teeth to get it. But the fact of the matter is, and we used a lot of our own money. I used a lot of my own money, too. We developed it, and, of course, the saturation levels went off the charts. I don't know what they are today, but I think they're well in excess of 50%. And we were practically impaled, and burned at the stake for suggesting we would have 1% saturation in that business. We got into it early. When we first started applying, nobody cared about it. The FCC opened the top 30 markets in the U.S. You know what they are: New York, Chicago, Boston, L.A., San Fran, Miami. You know those markets. They were the top 30 markets. And you know what happened? Almost nobody applied. For some of those cities, there were only two or three applicants. The average number of applicants was five. There were so few that we didn't even bother to go through the comparative proceeding process to pick a winner. We simply settled with the other applicants, and everybody took their pro rata share of the market. And everybody made a fortune on that market simply by filing the applications.
Well, what was the basis that the FCC was using to choose?
They were using comparative hearings at that time.
Oh, so you just bypassed them by just settling with everybody in advance.
Well, yeah, exactly. There was no need to have a hearing, and the commission was thrilled.
So you were an automatic winner.
Absolutely.
Excuse me, gentlemen.
Yes.
Would you have one more question?
All right.
Carrie LePage?
Yes, hi. I decided I want to come back in life as a waiter in Leo's favorite restaurant. Quick question. I know we're short on time. Why did the Chinese import-export business fail? Because I'm looking into that. Specifically,
we didn't know enough about China, and the guy that I sent as my emissary, while he was a brilliant guy with a genius IQ and very fast on his feet, didn't speak Mandarin or anything close to it, and he could never get through the cultural barriers. And we found that I don't want to generalize, and I don't like stereotypes, but we found that so many of those people will tell you almost anything just to end the meeting. And you think you have an agreement, and you leave blithely, expecting things to work out, and you never hear from them again, or they won't return your phone calls or whatever. So there was a lot of that. And also, that was one problem. Another problem was some of the, we set up offices. We had offices in Shanghai and Tianjin and so forth. And one of the things we were importing was beer, believe it or not. And they, we ran afoul of local politicians or something. And at one point, they imprisoned the guy who was our local manager of our office, and I think it was Tianjin. I didn't know them. I never went to China. I never knew any of those people. But so we had problems like that. And then I think getting in through customs was a bit of a problem. I don't know what was involved with that. How much corruption went on there, I don't know. But you end up hiring people to get your goods through customs, and it was a bit of a nightmare. So I don't really know.
How long
ago
was that, Leo?
Oh, dear, that was in about 1990.
So
and
things have changed a lot since then.
I'm sure they have. And then we tried to get licenses, wireless licenses, any one of which would have been worth a fortune. Or to share it with local. We had local partners, we thought, and but we there were about six or seven different levels of licenses. I mean, it's like you had to get a license for the parish, and then for the county, and then for the state, and then for the region, and finally you had to go to Beijing and get a license. And we could never get the last license, and so it failed at that level. We had a lot of licenses, but not enough to operate. If we had one more, I think we would have made well over $100 million on that one license.
So what do you you say you're looking into it? What are you trying to do?
Well, we've been importing hardware for my company for 10 years, but as a matter of fact, and I don't want to get too deep into this because I know you're short on time. I published my first book thanks to your help, in large part, Robert, and I thought, what if I could sell my book in China? And it's it's just wearing me out trying to tap into that market. I mean, they send so much over here. Why wouldn't they? They are introducing capitalism over there, as you know. Certainly nothing like ours, but there are some freedoms opening up, and I would think they would find a self-help book interesting. I mean, if you got one half of 1% of the readers over there.
Well, it sounds great. I think I have maybe three books published in simplified Chinese, but they don't sell a lot that I know of. And I was approached by agents. I'm approached from time to time by agents, but I'm just saying that they don't give much in the way of an advance. And I agree with you. You figure. What, 1.25 billion people, if you just by accident you would sell 1 million copies, but it just doesn't seem to work out that way, and I plead ignorance. I don't really know what's going on over there. I've never been there, and I've never tried to do business there, but for what it's worth, my books, as far as I can tell, have never sold in a big way, and I also don't know what the extent of the piracy is there, pirating books and CDs and stuff. I don't know whether that's a problem. I know years ago, one or two of my books popped up in Taiwan that they just took the book apart and used it as camera-ready originals. You know,
amazing.
So I really don't know. I really don't know. Okay.
Yes, sir. Thank you,
Lee. What I'd like you to do is just kind of wrap it up by finishing out that cellular. I think that's amazing that they had comparative hearings, 2 to 5 applicants per market, and that you went back to your crumbs theory and settled with everyone, and so you were an automatic winner. I mean, you can't beat that. So, how
interestingly, that
out?
People were amazingly slow to catch on to how good cellular was going to be. And when the first round was filed, if memory serves me correctly, in June of 1982, the second round, which was markets 31 through 60, was filed, I believe, in November of 82. So people have had a chance to see the first markets filed, and nobody got overly excited about what happened. And no one who filed nobody gave them a check the day they settled or anything. That didn't happen. But, I mean, when round two came along, the word still wasn't out. And the average number of applicants was about 11 per market.
Wow.
So if you settled on one of these monster markets, some of them might have been I don't have total recall here, but you know, some major Charleston, Charlotte, I don't know, good sized markets, millions of people, you got 1/11th on the settlement.
Amazing. And in those days, if you'd have told somebody that in the not too distant future, every kid was going to be walking down the street with a cell phone talking, nobody would have believed it.
Well, there would have been a stampede to file. You would have been crushed. You would have never gotten to the counter. But then when the third round came along, it was March of 1983, and it was market 61 through 90, and it was the same system. Well, a few more filed. The average number of applicants was 17. So if you had filed, anyone in this conversation had filed an application, wasn't that hard to do? You could have settled and gotten 1/17th of that market. What happened is they would settle for 1/17th each, and then they would merge into an entity, and the strongest pocket would then try. I mean, if they were a big public company, they'd say, will you guys accept our stock? And, you know, it was this kind of a thing. But you ended up with 1/17th, and that was to market 90. And so then then they went to markets 91 to 120 and 121 to 150 and 151 to 180 and on and on and on up into, there were about 400 or 500 markets. By the time they got to the last 100 markets or so, do you know how many applicants there were per market?
How many?
1,000 plus.
Wow. So there was a case of being early. Well, this has just been fascinating, and I'm going to just real quick go down. I'm sure everybody's taking copious notes, and you can get all this stuff, as you know, online, and Mike will clue you in. But some of the real high points from a standpoint of things that I think can help everyone out there, no matter what business they're in, here's some of the notes that I took, and you can compare. Everyone on the line can compare. No one will pay you what you'll pay yourself. Wealth is not what you make. It's what you own. Leo talked about developing ownership interests, asking for what you're worth, because it's something, and of course you're all familiar with my book, Action, one of the most important actions, ask. Ask again and again and again, and it's amazing what happens when you ask. Something that that Leo didn't emphasize a lot, but this did not happen overnight. It took him 10 years to play out the FM radio thing. One of his greatest statements, I've heard him make it many times in the past, he lived off the crumbs of other men's tables. If the table is big enough and the meal's big enough, you can become wealthy, as he can attest to. Run on a track with less competition, but don't be too early because you can be out.
Bob, let me just inject one thing.
Yep.
Bob, the living off the crumbs of other people's tables. When you do that, when you make a deal that the other guy is thrilled with, they will run so hard, and their economic interest will drive them to the wall to make that thing work. And that is another benefit of living, taking a little smaller piece.
And that goes with your philosophy of having concomitant interests, making sure that everybody at the table, not for altruistic reasons, for reasons of pragmatism, that there's really something in it for someone. And I know that Leo always likes to set deals up so people are going to bust themselves to try to make it work. How he overcame the discouragement fraternity, which I've preached over and over and over again in my books, no matter what deal you go into, whether it's telecommunications or whether it's importing from China or real estate, whatever it is, you will never have a shortage of people around you who are going to give you a negative input, and you got to decide early on whether you believe in your deal or not and stick with it. I thought his resourcefulness in the cable TV, the Tupperware approach, he goes in, says, well, let's try one block. He makes it easy on them to say yes. Find a way to make it easy on people to say yes, and then holds a tea party in a house and ends up signing 90% of the people, and from there the thing, you know, works. So even though he was turned down, he found another way to come. He couldn't get in the front door, so he came in the side door, and more resourcefulness, the comparative hearings, where he eliminated them by just settling with everybody, and everybody was a winner. And one of the most important things, because I know a lot of people out there are in businesses or have been in businesses where they're struggling, and you can listen and all day long to people tell you about cutting expenses, but really the small stuff is not where it's at. If you focus strictly on problems, or in the case of expenses, a business that's having problems, if you focus on cutting expenses, all that time that you're spending on cutting expenses, you're not concentrating on the opportunities, which is bringing in income. Those are kind of the highlights that really, you know, I got a lot of other things down here. You can never stop, and it just goes on and on. Leo, I thank you so much. I think this was absolutely phenomenal. I think you've given people $10 million worth of wisdom here, and I'm sure everybody's going to looking forward to clicking onto the Internet whenever it's up and hearing this over and over. You can download it onto your own computers. And so, Leo, I want to again thank you for giving us all of this valuable input.
Well, it's my pleasure, Robert. Always a pleasure to be with you, and I applaud your continuing efforts, your books, and wish all your subscribers and fan base all the best as well.
Great. Mike, you want to take it over?
Yes, sir. I give you my thanks, too, Leo. Just terrific. I just am thrilled that we had you on the line today.